Hello, this is Barbara Van Dalen. Thank you for joining me today on Inner Space. Inner Space is a special program that helps us pay attention to our own emotional health and well-being and the health and well-being of those we love. For this episode of Inner Space, we're talking about relationships and families, how they shape us, and the importance of working through the struggles we inevitably face. Sometimes our families pull together during times of crisis. Sometimes, despite our best efforts, our families can't withstand the strain and relationships end or change dramatically. As always, here on Inner Space, our focus is on how we can support and maintain emotional health and well-being during the best of times and the worst of times. As a child, I lived through some difficult years and the end of my parents' marriage. Our family didn't know how to help my mom with her mental illness, and we didn't really talk about what was happening to each of us as a result of the strain. Looking back, I wonder what could have happened if different resources had been available to us and to her. As an adult, my marriage to the father of my children ended painfully, but the love I now have with my husband Randy, who happily stepped up to become the father my daughters needed, has transformed my life. Today's guests are all in the process of healing, rebuilding, and sharing what has helped them and their families. First, I sit down with Ricky Lake, whose husband's suicide led her to think very differently about herself and mental health. Then I meet with Wayne Brady and his ex-wife, Mandy Takeda, who together are redefining family and challenging us all to rethink how we understand divorce. Finally, I catch up with my dear friend, Fred Knowles, whose family tragedy led to a writing career and a professional opportunity he never could have imagined. Before I sat down with former talk show host and documentary filmmaker Ricky Lake, I had no idea how many experiences we share. She was gracious enough to open up to me about her beloved husband, his mental illness, and ultimately what the experience of loving him during the worst of times taught her about her life's purpose. So I'm here in Los Angeles today with Ricky Lake to talk about all variety of things related to our inner space and how we take care of it. So Ricky, a pleasure to meet you, first of all.
Yes, pleasure to meet you as well.
And thank you for taking the time to be here today and to share your story. So many of our listeners will know you as an actress and
a lot of different things.
A talk show host, yeah. A documentarian, which I didn't know until I started doing some research. So I'd like to start, if we can, because it sort of gives people the context for sort of for what you're doing now in this space. Mm-hmm. So a very good friend of mine is Talinda Bennington. And Talinda was, we have been hanging out while I've been in LA doing these interviews this week. And I was with her last night and she was saying, oh, who's on the show tomorrow? And I said, oh, I'm meeting Ricky Lake. And she said, oh, I met her and she just wanted me to share her regards.
We met at an event for Bring Change to Mind.
Yes, yes.
A group that I'm very, very fond of the work they do. And, you know, they of course, their focus is changing the stigma on mental illness, particularly with young people.
Absolutely.
So my husband, my beloved who passed away 23 months ago, but who's counting, he struggled, you know, his whole life. He was bipolar. He had a lot of issues, chronic pain, learning issues, learning disabilities, and wasn't diagnosed. So, I mean, I think things could have been different for him had he been diagnosed, given the care, given the support, and also not have the stigma, you know, once he was diagnosed and once he, you know, so, yeah, it really helps with my healing process to be of service in this way.
That's so important. And that's really the heart and soul of what we're talking about is culture change and how do we get there? And in order to change culture, we have to understand what gets in our way of being open and honest and sharing. I said, you know, that I, doing research to meet you today, you've been open about your childhood. You know, you had your own share of pain, and that certainly affected and shaped you. Can you talk a little bit about where you come from?
And I don't think I'm unique in that. I think all of us suffer trauma and
loss.
Hardship and loss and hurt and rejection. I mean, all the things that you have to, you know, go through in life. So I'm not unique, but I was molested as a small child, and, you know, that really affected me. You know,
How old were you?
I was six, and I've talked about it in the past, and I've certainly made peace with it. But what that experience I think did for me, it caused me to turn to food, which caused me to gain a lot of weight. So I was an overweight teenager, and then an obese young adult. But in a weird way, it was a blessing and not a curse, because it actually helped me to secure my first job, Hairspray. Mm-hmm. So it literally was like a gift, you know, and going back, my mother, who I, you know, don't have a relationship with, but she was, you know, had eating disorders my whole life as a child. She had body dysmorphia. She was addicted to diet pills. You know, she was caught up in the exterior. And so for me to be her fat teenage daughter, you know, she was so ashamed. She didn't know how to manage it. She, you know, and
in your family, because one of the things that we're talking a lot about with guests who come on is, did people around you know how to talk about these inner issues? Did people know even to talk about them?
I was molested for a period of time. And then when I eventually told my parents, they fired this man who worked on my property, you know, and he was gone, and it was never discussed again. I was never given therapy. It was literally like it never happened.
When you look back at the challenges and the trauma and the pain, how would it have been helpful to you if people could have around you, whoever, could have talked more and helped you understand? How could it have helped you? How would it have been useful?
I mean, I can't even imagine. I don't know how else, you know, because we didn't talk about things in my family. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was swept under the rug. And so I guess an open line of communication would certainly have been beneficial, you know, for me to understand how prevalent, because when I didn't talk about the molestation until I was 21 years old. So I was six until 21. Wow. And it was a guy that I was interested in, and I opened up to him about it. But before then, I felt like I was almost the only one, you know, like,
yes,
it felt like it was just happened to me. And to know that it happens to so many of us, yes. I mean, not that it should be normalized, but you know, I felt like a freak in so many ways.
Yeah.
And I was not sexually active for a very long time. And I, you know, had such severe body image issues, you know, which I still contend with today. But you know, I've made peace of that experience. And I've even forgiven the
abuser.
Predator.
Yes.
I do, you know, because it doesn't help to hold on to. Well, I don't blame my mother either. My mother was there. My mother was upstairs. Every time that it happened, my mother was home and didn't protect me. And so for a long time, I had some issues, some anger towards her, but she did the best she could.
Well, and forgiveness is, if we can get there, it's very liberating.
Absolutely.
I imagine that you are a different kind of mom with your sons.
My children, yes.
That you, my guess is you do talk to them, mm-hmm, about whatever.
Yes, absolutely. My youngest son keeps everything close to the vest. Mm-hmm. He is not someone that really talks about his feelings, mm-hmm, which, you know, has been not a concern. Maybe that's too strong a word, but I've been aware of the fact that he doesn't like to talk. I don't know if he's 17. I don't know if he's ever had a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. He won't tell me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure he has, but he doesn't share that with me.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sensitive, and, you know, I'm watching him.
But the fact that he knows that you're there, that you are watching, that you are offering, that you are tuned in is huge.
Yeah, I'm definitely handling things differently than my mother did,
yeah,
with me. I think my sons would agree. You know, I really am very, it's particularly there, you know, my sons are 21 and 17.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a son graduating from college, mm-hmm, and one graduating high school.
I have two girls, 22 and 18.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
it's
exciting time.
It's like we've come out the other side, and they're such great people. Mine are, mm-hmm, such great people. Mm-hmm. I am so proud. Mm-hmm. Like, and I know I've done a good job, mm-hmm, you know, and a lot of it felt like being a single parent because, you know, My first husband didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things. I mean, it was very challenging for many years. And the fact that, particularly my oldest, my youngest is still like a work in progress, I think. But my oldest, Milo, is super impressive.
Mm.
Like he's incredible. Like I'm honored to call him my son. You know,
aww,
he's kind. He's doing beautiful work.
It's
knock
neat.
Wood, knock something.
Well, it's I think it sounds like you and I have some shared experience. I too was a single mom and had a very unhappy separation, divorce, that had a profound effect on my two daughters.
And how old were they?
They were five and 9 finally when the marriage
ended.
Mine
was 6 and 2 when I first separated, and then, yeah.
Childhood is a time of many things, growth, exploration, loss, pain. I mean, you can't grow up without some, and all we can do is our best jobs as mommies and daddies and parents to be there with them, be there for them, allow them to be whoever and experience whatever. And I too am really proud to see who my kids are becoming.
It's amazing.
You know,
yeah.
You see parts of you in there, and then you go, wait, what is that part? I don't know what that is. It's not me. It's not, you know, I remarried, and they are very close to their stepfather, so they're blessed, and our family
more
is.
People to love. Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, Christian coming into my life was a huge gift for all of us. They adored him. You know?
Talk about his struggle, because it, from what I understand, what you've shared is that he was very open.
Very open.
This is part of me.
He was a man of his word, and he was suicidal at that time. So he was bipolar, and I didn't understand what bipolar was at that time. When he told me, I've been diagnosed bipolar, my reaction was, oh yeah, we all have our, you know, I'm a control freak, you know?
Mm-hmm, right.
We all have our stuff. You know, I really didn't understand what that was. I was so madly in love. Christian was so challenged, you know, and at the time I didn't really recognize it. You know, he had such pain, chronic pain from a car accident, migraines all the time, you know, self-esteem issues, processing issues. I mean, he was brilliant. He was like, and I describe him, it sounds like he was like less than, but he was someone I revered and had so many gifts, but he suffered. He
terribly
suffered.
It sounds like.
He
and
suffered.
For a long time.
We had like a running kind of thing where I'd wake up in the morning, I'd be like, ah, I can't wait to see what this day brings. Uh-huh. And he would wake up every morning and be like, fuck, I have to go through it again. Like, mm-hmm. Really? Like
that every day was a struggle.
Lot. Every yeah. day. I mean, we had a lot of fun together, and I was never happier. I mean, in a lot of ways, I was almost never happier than when the days I was with him. But yes, it was a struggle. Looking back on it now that I'm with someone who's healthy, who doesn't have mental illness, it is night and day.
And it sounds like that Christian never found what worked for him.
No.
Because
medicine didn't work. Western medicine did not work. And he had had 2 bouts of psychotic breaks with me in the 6.5 years.
People who are listening may themselves, either they themselves are bipolar or they have family members. And there's a guest that we've had on the show who talks very openly about her bipolar and how she has found her way that works very well to manage it. It's a combination of things, mm-hmm. and it's lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. And so, it's food protocol. I know food protocol is big, and mindfulness.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. I.
So some people listening may think, oh, well, that bipolar is like mine or like someone else's, or and what you're sharing helps me understand as a psychologist that because like pretty much everything about humans, it's a continuum, mm-hmm. and we can have, you know, mild to moderate depression. We can have severe depression where you cannot, literally cannot get out of bed.
Yeah, he had that
anxiety,
sometimes.
The same kind of thing. Bipolar as well. You can have bipolar where you have these horrific psychotic episodes that must have been terrifying for you and
the first
your
one,
boys.
The first one came out of the blue. And the problem with, or my experience with Christian. So Christian, the psychiatrist would say my husband would operate on a -1. We're at a 0. He's just under.
Always.
So he's always like tough to get out of bed, tough to motivate, you know, and he just, it was struggle for him. You know, that was his base.
Yep.
So when the mania started, it presents like, he's on fire.
Right.
He's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, he was getting up in the morning. He's oil pulling. He's meditating. He's got all these ideas. My man was like back, you know, and it was his sister calling me out of the blue crying because she could tell from his social media that he was having an episode.
Oh.
And I'd never experienced an episode before. And he was very cautious to protect me. He didn't want me to know the backstory. I mean, he was very transparent on the one, but he also was doing everything he could to protect this relationship. And so he didn't want his sister to
out
called
him.
Me out of the blue crying, and mm-hmm. she, precious soul, Colette, is, I'm seeing her in a couple weeks, mm. very close to her and her family. But, you know, she said, I am so sorry to tell you this, but I believe my brother's in mania. Watch for him not sleeping. Watch for him not eating. Watch for him having grandiose thoughts. Watch for, I mean, all these things. Yeah. And it was exactly what was happening. And so while it presents really well for a period of time, it keeps going higher.
Yeah.
And then we couldn't get him back. I mean, mm-hmm. he was, so that was the first episode. He thought he could fly. He thought he could time travel. He left his car on the side of the road because he didn't need any more. He was giving all this money away to all these charities. I mean, it was just out of control.
Yes.
Calling the tabloids. I mean, it was like out of control.
Yes.
And it was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He became
his brain wasn't functioning.
His voice would change. His the look in his eyes. I mean, mm-hmm. he looks like a different person. And it was terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing I could do. And that was the frustrating thing. I'm this high profile person who has money, who has resources and health insurance. And yet we couldn't, it had to happen the way it did. And he had to crash on his own. And then he became suicidal and called me out of the blue after not speaking for 2.5 months and me trying to get my life back in order, threatening to kill himself. I had to get him on a 5150. Then I had to put him in a treatment center, supposedly the best for bipolar. It was a shit show. It was a nightmare.
It sounds like just so exhausting, demanding,
terrifying,
overwhelming. And as you said, you had resources. So this says to us, doesn't it, that we got a long way to go mm-hmm. as a society.
Yeah.
In order to figure out better ways to care for
Absolutely.
People who are suffering like this. So when he died, Were you surprised?
Yes, I did not see it coming, mm-hmm. but I was not, I guess I wasn't surprised, but I did not expect it. And so one of the things, you know, we weren't legally married when he died, but we were still together. Mm-hmm. So I still refer to him
yes,
as my husband.
Husband. Yeah.
Because after the first episode, I had to protect myself.
Mm-hmm.
Which was the right thing to do. It was the most hurtful thing for him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I really had no choice. So after the first episode in 2014, we got back together in early 2015, and then we're together for another year, almost 2 years, until it happened again in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happened, same thing. This escalation around my birthday, the crash around Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. We were in touch after that. I couldn't take him back because it would be to the detriment of everything in my life, including my children and everything.
It must have been such a hard.
It was hard.
Decision.
It was horrible. It was horrible. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I still, you know, I, like I said, I have this new love in my life and I have found my joy again and I'm very much in a great place. But yeah, it's tragic that I couldn't fix him, you know,
yeah.
And I fix everything. I'm like,
and you were willing and you wanted and the love.
I would have given anything mm-hmm. to help him. So yeah, so we separated again and got back in touch around Thanksgiving. And then I was checking on him. He was living in Arizona. I was in LA and, I was saying, are you getting fresh air? Are you taking your medication? Are you, you know, eating well? I mean, I was sending him money. I was just trying to like be a friend to him. And, in January, you know, we had talked about he was going to come visit. He's going to come through LA and, you know, and we had one final text exchange, not a final text exchange, but one text exchange involved, you know, him basically saying, I can't live without you. And I said, well, yes, you can. And you're not without me. I'm here. I'm your friend. I'm here for you. And, I said, but I will not be a caretaker for anyone ever again. And he said, I hear you loud and clear. And I believe it was then that he got a gun on Craigslist. And that a couple weeks later, we made a plan to, we hadn't seen each other for a few months and we saw each other. I think it was February 6th and 7th. And I did everything that everyone told me not to do. So my friends, my therapist, everyone said, don't see him at night.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have alcohol. Don't
mm-hmm.
bring him home.
Mm-hmm.
Don't, you know, see him for coffee in the day. Just, you know, don't sleep with him. And mm-hmm. I think, God, I didn't listen to anyone because I, you know, met him for happy hour. He wasn't a drinker, but I, you know, we both had a couple of drinks and sushi and I brought him home and we had this beautiful time together and it was his goodbye to me. I didn't know it at the time,
mm-hmm.
but this was his closure for me. And
it sounds like you feel blessed that you had that with him.
Had I rejected him and he had done this, it would be a totally different story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I followed my heart. I never stopped loving him.
Mm-hmm.
He was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm profoundly better having loved him and lost him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there is purpose. You know, he struggled with purpose his whole life, but I believe I'm supposed to be this vessel and this catalyst to share my story and to hopefully help others.
And it sounds like his purpose lives on through you, mm-hmm. that his pain and suffering, although it was horrible and tragic, like you said, we should have been able to save him. He wanted to be saved. You wanted to save him.
I don't think he wanted to be saved. No,
you don't think
I don't.
So? Mm-mm.
My husband was like, he described himself as an alien. He was constantly straddling different realms. Like he was. Mm-hmm. He was not in this body, in this human form. This was not his prime. Mm-hmm. Where he is now, and I will tell you, I can get really like out there with you, but I could tell you the most healing thing I've done in the 2 years since his passing, almost 2 years. I had a psychic experience, experience with a medium who channeled him for an hour. Mm-hmm. And I was able to actually... He made amends. I mean, he explained everything to me, 100%. I mean, you may look at me like I'm crazy.
No, I think we don't, how can we judge, how can I judge you and how do I know? I don't think we know. I mean, I've lost many people in my life and I have felt things and not understood. I don't know what this is. So no, all I know, it's very clear from talking to you that that was incredibly helpful and valuable.
Absolutely.
And has given you a sense of peace that perhaps that is where he's now free.
He is completely free. Mm-hmm. And so when he passed, I wasn't angry. I didn't ask why. I completely understood why. It was not a selfish thing. People talk about suicide being selfish. It's anything but. Mm-hmm. Cut to, you know, now I make these documentaries that really are about something that I believe is important. I have a new one called Weed the People, which is about cannabis oil and children with pediatric cancer. Mm. So we followed these children for 5.5 years while they were both on chemotherapy and also given cannabis oil. And the results are remarkable. Mm. And this plant has been demonized. And, you know, it's just so that's, and then my next film is about hormonal birth control coming out later in the year. Huh. So that one will really piss off Big Pharma.
but again, this is all about trying to give your gift to help our society be healthier, caring for people you don't even know who maybe will learn something from these documentaries that allow them to make choices that help them or someone they love.
Absolutely. I mean, it's crazy. My partner, Abby Epstein, and I, we make these films together. She's my director. And it happens 3 times a week on average where women come up to us and like start crying. They were so impacted by what they learned from the film that they were able to have this birth experience that they never would have had otherwise. Mm. You know, so no, I love the work I get to do now. And even with the loss of Christian and now being an advocate for mental health awareness, and it's my pleasure. It is an honor for me to use my voice to hopefully help people.
I want to thank Ricky Lake for stopping by and for using her voice and her experience to help others who may be struggling to help a loved one. An important takeaway from our conversation is that there is no one size to help those who are in emotional pain. Indeed, there are many ways to heal and recover. I encourage all of my listeners who are going through a difficult time to continue to reach out to those you trust for help. Continue to do your own research, and if it works for you, be your own advocate to find what you need to care for your inner space. Another important tip that Ricky shared is that communicating, talking about the challenges we experience with those closest to us is so important for our families, for our health, and for our survival. My next guests couldn't agree more. Wayne Brady wears many hats. He's an actor, a comedian, and a TV host. But when he's not in the public eye, he's also a father and an ex-husband, who, along with his ex-wife, Mandy Takeda, is redefining what divorce can look like when parents are committed to raising their children together and remaining friends. We sat down to discuss their journey as a family and what they want to share with others.
So I would love to start, if we can, just by the two of you telling our audience about sort of each of you and your relationship, because you were married, but now you're not. Mm-hmm. But you're here together. So clearly you've been able to be together and not be together, but be healthy, it looks like, because you have a daughter in common.
Yes.
So can you give us just the history of when you got married and how long you were together, and maybe even if you could fill in the gaps of what you're comfortable with around Wayne. You've shared about dealing with depression. and how that might have affected the relationship or not. And I'll just ask you questions along the way.
First, I think, I hope we reach a day when for two people that were married to co-parent or to exist in harmony isn't looked at like a circus sideshow or such an oddity.
I agree.
Because it makes no sense to me. Mm-hmm. Unless someone has done you some grievous wrong or so much has gone downhill that truly I need to excise this person from my life if you have children, there's no reason why you can't be on the same page. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It's work. It's work every day. And just like any friends or family members, you've got ups and downs. You've got days when you want to talk to each other. You have days when you don't want to talk to each other. You have days when you're like, man, I'm so glad that we're not married because I don't have to have certain discussions or what. Those are human things. Mm-hmm. But then you also have days when we look at each other and we go, oh, isn't it amazing that we have this kid? Mm-hmm. We have a shorthand that no one else that I know in my life can speak. Mm-hmm. I've known her just as long as I've known certain family members, save my parents maybe, mm-hmm. and my sister. Mm-hmm. You know, so when we start off conversations like, wow, you guys are raising a child. That is amazing. You've got three heads. Circus. It shouldn't be that. And I think to a degree, in a very reaching way, I think that in a lot of relationships, mental health does play a part. And not mental health saying that someone has to be suffering from something. I'm saying the mental, your actual mental health that you check in
every day.
Yeah, every that day. You check in with yourself and check in with your partner.
So before we go into that, very thoughtful commentary about the way our society should view a couple that's raising a child together, even though they're divorced. But we're not there yet, and so it's lovely that the two of you are doing that and that you're doing it in a way that is public. It whether you choose to be or not, whether you set out to go, we're going to do this as a model, I do hope that people look at you and say, you know what, let's try to put our differences aside. My own life had a very painful divorce and was not able to do that with my ex-husband, my girl's father. And I remarried and have a good partner, and we're doing that. And we all tried. It sometimes isn't possible.
Right.
But the fact that you guys are doing it, I think gives people hope that maybe if they can do it,
because
I know.
It's for the kids.
It's for the kid. Yes.
And
yes.
And not just for the kids. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to monopolize. And not just for the kids. I mean, Mandy and I were friends before we got married.
We're going on 21 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, it's more.
Wow.
Okay,
well.
And we were friends before then, and then we got married. We happen to like each other. Mm-hmm. We work together. We have a production company. Mm-hmm. We have Miley. We have things that we actually like to do in common.
That's so nice. And like you said, you were friends first.
Yeah.
So the fact that you can continue that, that's a gift to each of you and to your daughter, obviously.
I think we had an awesome marriage. Mm-hmm. We didn't fail. I think we just kind of moved on after learning a bit about self-care and love and learning about health. And so it doesn't bother me, but we're not sitting here because we have a daughter. Mm-hmm. For me, I love Wayne.
Mm.
You know, he's known me longer than anyone I know, and he knows me better than any family member I have.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, even if we didn't have Miley, I'd still have Wayne's back.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
same.
But we're not lucky as well. Like, we are, but people say, you guys are so lucky. But no, we work really
hard.
We've gone through, we've done a ton of therapy. We still do. Mm-hmm. It's been going on over a decade. So, I mean, it's not easy, but worth it.
Well, that's a great message. And one of the things that I think we're trying to help people who are tuning in and listening is exactly that, Mandy. It's taking care of yourself, taking care of somebody you love, taking care of your kids. It's not always easy. It can be joyful in its whatever. It's hard work, sometimes it's effortless. But this notion of that people are either healthy or they're not, or they're lucky, it takes work. Relationships take work. Raising kids take work. Our mental health takes work.
So much work. And that kind of ties into our story. I wasn't aware of how much work. I don't think that anyone really is until you delve into it. And And it wasn't until I reached a point where even Mandy was saying, right before we got divorced, I think that you need to look into this. I think you need to check your mental health. I think you need to talk to someone. I think you need to be open with certain feelings. Luckily, Mandy wanted to, for me to get help, and she knew that in order for her to get help, we had to pull ourselves out of this place. And at that point, that place was marriage. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see that. I just kept looking at it as, well, if we get divorced, now I failed. And this is horrible. Mm-hmm. And I'm bad. And I'm this. And mm-hmm. I'm that. And then you lump all of that stuff mm-hmm. on yourself. And I wish I could say that I immediately jumped into counseling right then and it started to get fixed. It took another few years. Even once we were separated, even once we were divorced, it took years for me to finally one day just go, okay, I can't live like this. Maybe I will talk to someone and see what's going on. And then at that point, things aren't perfect because you have good days, you have bad days, you have great days, you have completely shitty days.
Yeah.
But at least now I can say that I'm armed with tools mm-hmm. and I'm armed with a vocabulary for health. And so is Mandy, and I'll let her explain all the work that she's done, but she's had to do work as I have in codependency, in parenting, in parenting your child, in parenting yourself. Mm-hmm. Because so many of your parental choices, as you know, are reflections of the kid that you have to parent.
Yes.
And it took that for me to go, oh, you mean there's more work that I've got to go back and find out about my father, and I have to go back and find out why did this happen when I was... Those are things that I think to some people, as soon as you say that you're going to a therapist, oh, you're going to the shrink, then you must be crazy, mm-hmm. especially in the Black community.
Can we stop there? Because I want to, before we pass on that, you mentioned that now you have the language, now you have tools, and it's so clear, you know, how powerful that is for you, and it makes me, as somebody who has spent my career working on this, and it makes me very happy that you found good people to help you with that. Sounds like when you were growing up, those tools didn't exist, the language didn't exist, and people didn't talk about these things. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Did you even know what depression, what that was, what it meant?
Absolutely not. As a child, I don't even think, and I'm not trying to be funny, I think outside of terms like, you know, the country, the Great Depression, or did I'd never heard the term used for anyone that I knew. Hmm. Oh, this person's depressed. Because growing up where I grew up.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Orlando, Florida, okay. In a neighborhood called Tangelo Park. I'm predominantly Black neighborhood, lower middle class, mm-hmm. lower. It's that joke in the Black community of, you know, everybody's got a crazy uncle. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's crazy, Uncle Jimmy. Look over here, talking in the corner, burn. Mm-hmm. This is so funny. It's just crazy. This is crazy. We treat it like that. Mm-hmm. And then if someone says, well, I'm going to go to a therapist or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, well, that's just for white folks. We aren't crazy. There's a stigma, and I'm not saying it's just in that community. I'm only speaking from myself. Mm-hmm. I think there's a stigma in general, mm-hmm. and you look in certain, you know, there is a machismo component connected to a lot of, mm-hmm. lot of different different communities. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying that in mine, that was a huge sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. You're what? Mm-hmm. You're depressed. You need to go to a doctor. Mm-hmm. That's crazy, and you're crazy for saying that you're crazy, but you don't need to and throwing that word around. Mm-hmm. So. Even if I felt bad or felt anything, I would have never said that. And knowing now the way that my disease worked, I have always experienced it. It was just that I was on I'm not going to say manic, but close to it. Most of my life was always on a...
Driven?
On a driven. And so even if I had episodes... I didn't notice them because I was constantly moving and didn't have time. It was only when things came to a standstill at a few points early on, now I can look back And Mandy was with me four of those times. Like once when I went, when I hurt my knee and went to the doctor. And then another time, it was any time that there was any loss or hurt and I had to stand still. Then it was like, no, the world is horrible. How am I? Oh, I'm fine now. And then I kept on moving.
On you went. Before we leave your early years, Wayne, when you look back now in your own family, can you see depression now that you know what it is? Can you see signs it's in the family mix there?
I now can say absolutely that I grew up in the throes of it and I wasn't aware.
And isn't it sad? And I hope I see in my lifetime where this changes, because that means there's a lot of suffering that happened and continues to happen, right?
So much.
So, Mandy, in your family, did people talk about mental health, emotional health and well-being, depression, anxiety? Were those things that people, if somebody was suffering or hurting in that way, that it was addressed or talked about?
Absolutely not.
Where did you grow up?
In Honolulu, Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the oldest of four.
Hmm.
And it's not something we talked about at all. I mean, my mom got very sick when I was 13, and she spent 11 years of her life dying, so she was bedridden for most of that time.
So
my dad was like a single father and took care of us and worked every day and sent us to school every day. We did martial arts. He is such a good parent.
Mm.
But as far as how do you feel about this, we didn't talk about it. It was kind of, suck it up. We're so lucky to be together. Suck it up. We're so lucky to eat. We're so lucky to be alive that almost like you should feel bad if you're too happy because something, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was the perfect mate for Wayne when we met. I'm just totally codependent and we just totally, you know. And so it wasn't.
And you were both hurting. You both came from.
We didn't know.
No, but
I felt so lucky.
Right.
So lucky I could help take care of, you know, and then help make Wayne happy.
And that was someone who was willing.
Yeah.
And
that made me happy.
Yeah.
And in meeting her and her family, it's a joke because I'm a very affectionate person with the people that I love.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting when we met, because even to hug someone that you're dating, I was like, I feel it to a degree. I brought that energy into her family, so now I can hug her dad, who I call dad.
Aww.
And it's so interesting to see people live a very closed off way, and I experienced some of that myself growing up, which is why I felt I went the opposite way of wanting and needing affectioning, and that's my way of expressing myself.
And I ran from it because I didn't want to see my dad upset. I didn't want to see, if I hug someone too long, you know, you might start to tear up.
Crying.
And heaven forbid, like, you cry. That's awful, you know. And it just, so it's a good balance. And the healing helps heal, right? So
absolutely.
Even this past holiday when we went home, my dad gives very long hugs now. Yeah. But it's been over 20-something years of, you know, slow discovery and just learning what healthy is.
So you didn't have, neither one of you had the language, you didn't know what was happening. I mean, you could feel it, you know, that this was not good or healthy or happy, but you didn't have the language really to talk about it. It doesn't sound like back then when you first came together.
I feel like it took a good decade before I could feel like that wasn't happiness. I didn't know how to distinguish what happy was and what healthy was and what unhealthy was until after we had Miley.
So talk about that, about having her and how it changed your life together, individually, because I didn't grow up with a mom, and so it was so important for me to be a good mom.
Yes.
And I was, you know, determined, whatever else happened, come hell or high water. And so, and it was transformative for me to have my own child and to have that mother-daughter, which I never had. So talk about the power and what it did for each of you individually, the family, because clearly it sounds like it, having her continues to be this power in your family.
I feel like it was more of a stress than a power at first, because you were raised by your grandmother, so your parents weren't necessarily there. My mom was sick, and I grew up very fast. I became the caretaker for my brothers and sisters and my mom, and that. The pressure of parent wanting to be the best parent for this one child that we have was so high that it wasn't real. Mm. And we didn't have the language. I feel that that made me curious as to like what we're missing, because parenting should not feel this stressful.
Stressful.
Right. And wanting to make the good decisions and wanting her to be raised differently than us. Mm. Like, we knew that there was something missing, but I think it was more stress than bliss for me at first. And that's what kind of triggered, I think, let's get separated, we need a divorce, because there's something missing from us. That's what kind of started me thinking. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think?
It sounds like maybe that you, at whatever level, even if you didn't know sort of the words to put on it, you wanted her to have some this goodness, the health, the well-being, whatever the words or lack of words, that was important to you.
Yeah, and I, you know what? I loved Wayne so much that I felt, I knew it was possible to love him even more. I just didn't, I lacked compassion because I did not have the information. Hmm. And I want Miley to have us there for her. Hmm. I want her to see what love is. It may not be married, but we love each other and she's from love. So that's what made me, I turned into like the spiritual gangster. Well, it's kind of like, let's figure this out. Something is missing. What is it, you know?
If you hadn't have taken those steps, I honestly don't know how I would have come about to having the information. I really don't know. I don't know how I would have put...
You're not sure you would have started the journey?
I can't say that I am strong enough in that way or have enough fortitude to have chosen that journey. Maybe I would have... Maybe there was a dark road ahead of me, or darker, but because she started it and pushed me towards that, I think I was able to avoid a lot of badness in that I think a lot of people bump into when they are trying to find out what's wrong with them. Mm-hmm. Because at first, I think there is a bit of denial. Because when someone says... I think you're not well, or I think you need to check on your mental health. What? Mm-hmm. Immediately. That's not, I'm not schizophrenic. I don't talk to myself in my sleep. What?
And you get so. I'm not crazy uncle so-and-so, right?
Right, I'm not that dude. And, right. And you get so offended. Mm-hmm. And once all that was broken down, I'm so happy that she took that leap and pushed me, because it changed my life. And
that came after you all separated, or was that when you were still together before?
That was after we were separated.
You cared enough about him to try to help him see. How did you do that?
It probably wasn't the healthiest way. I mean, it sounds nice, but I also did it because, maybe it was an excuse, but for our daughter. Mm-hmm. I didn't love myself enough to do it for me yet. So I'm like, this is a pattern I want to change for her first. Mm-hmm. And then later learned that, oh, I should have loved myself first, and, you know, I can't take care of her because I have a lot of issues too, you know. It's not all Wayne's fault, and I blamed him a lot, you know, and I feel like I would have done things differently, but I'm lucky that it worked out the way that it did.
I think sometimes we get caught up in, after we understand how it could have been, there's a lot of regret. Oh, I wish I would have, you know. Mm-hmm. But as you both sort of suggested, however you get there, it's really a blessing and a gift. However you get to the other side,
amen.
You know, then it's like to have that where you can actually be grateful and appreciate, wow, here's where I am. Thank God I got here. It's really lovely that you have that perspective, and it's lovely that you cared enough for this man after you were divorced, after you were no longer married, that you, as you said, you still loved him. It wasn't that you fought to push and for her, for him. And it sounds like eventually then it allowed you to find good stuff for you.
I want to thank Wayne and Mandy for stopping by to share their story of love and respect beyond divorce. Theirs is a wonderful example of how we can all work through emotional pain and disappointment to take care of ourselves and those we love, even if we end up loving each other in a different way. Wayne and Mandy have used a number of approaches, habits, and tools to be the healthiest they can be for their daughter and themselves. We can all learn from their experience. Like Wayne and Mandy, my next guest is no stranger to hard work and dedication. He's gifted in many areas, but his sense of humor and quick wit are skills that clearly helped him navigate some very painful and wrenching life experiences. I also love how he steps into opportunities that challenge him, and how he has taken the lessons he's learned and is sharing them to help others who might be struggling. Fred Knowles and I have known each other since our kids attended the same sweet elementary school. Even before we became close friends, I approached Fred to join the fledgling board for the organization I founded 14 years ago, Given Hour. We literally sat in my dining room during those early years, mapping out our vision and our hopes for bringing emotional health and well-being to those in need. Fred is now the chair of Given Hour's board. He is also a former corporate executive, a successful entrepreneur, the writer of a very funny self-help book, and a sitcom screenwriter. Fred's journey hasn't been without pain, but he has consistently found hope and humor to help him heal and move forward. And the fact that he is a really funny guy hasn't hurt at all. We sat down to catch up and to discuss the use of humor and the importance of practicing healthy habits. Let's start at the beginning. We've known each other now quite a long time.
Almost 20 years.
Oh, we were very young when we met.
We were young.
And we actually met because our children were our oldest children, your son, my daughter, were in the same adorable little school together, weren't they?
They were. Now they're college graduates.
I know. So we knew each other at this little school.
Yes.
And I had this idea to start a nonprofit organization. And I didn't, you and I, we were friendly because our kids were in the same school, but we didn't know each other well.
No, we would talk at some of the lunches and the like, but yeah, really didn't know each other.
Right. And at that point, you were at Capital One.
Correct.
And I didn't really know anything about what you did or anything about you really in any way. But I was, because I was creating this nonprofit, I was looking for people to serve on my first board, and one of the other parents who was helping me said, I think I can get Fred to join the board, right?
Absolutely.
And today, let all of our listeners and viewers know that Fred is actually the chair of the Given Hour Board of Directors.
Yeah, very humbled to be in that position. It's responsibility that I love.
Thank you.
You know, and just working with someone like you has been incredible. And I think the organization has just started to scratch the surface.
Cool. And this is fun for me because, and hopefully for you, because we don't get to talk much about those early days. And the reason why I think it's fun to talk about and useful for people who are listening, one, they get a little bit of a, you know, they get sort of to know how I came to be sitting here. But it also, I think, is really important about, you know, the power of one or two. That, you know, I asked you, we gathered a few more people, and we literally sat around my dining room table. And I was a single mom at the time.
Yeah.
And our board was and continues to be very hands-on, people, you know, diving in to help where they could. And we learned together what we needed to do to build a nonprofit organization that now, I'll do a little plug for my own organization. We've given, to date, over 265,000 hours of free care, which is about $26.5 million, right?
It's incredible. And I think it really goes back to the simplicity of your vision.
Thank you.
When you really broke it down, very hard to execute. Not
yes.
saying it's an easy thing
right.
to do.
Not an easy
but
thing.
But just, you know, this idea of people giving an hour.
Yes.
And matching providers with people in need. And doing that on a scaled basis. And doing it in an area like mental health where there's so much need. I mean, just those sentences flow off your tongue, but nobody took it and ran with it like you did.
Well, thank you.
And for me, just being involved in it has been so gratifying and fun. And just watching how, you know, you were not a corporate leader than I was used to.
I wasn't a corporate leader at all.
At all, right? And I remember we had a coach for you for a little while, remember?
Yeah.
You didn't need it.
And I think, and this sort of leads me to the you know, second sort of place where I want to travel with you, which is that I think that mental health, being aware of emotional health and well-being, certainly it has been a tremendous help to me as a leader. Kind of leave that out there for a minute. We'll come back to the corporate universe, which you know huge amounts about, having spent so many years of your career. But before that, I want to go personal. So when I asked you to join Given Hour, it was because of your corporate connections, because you were in the HR space.
Correct.
And I thought, okay, you could be really helpful to us, which you were, and a really sort of solid and steady voice about how to work with sponsors and all of that. But I didn't know, Fred, I didn't know that this mental health space was something that you're not a mental health professional, but you did know about it, didn't you?
I did. My family was hit pretty hard by mental health issues.
Yes.
My dad had bipolar, and he had 5 kids with bipolar. And back in the 60s, you know, nobody really talked about it. And they did.
Did you know the name of it when you were a kid?
I didn't. I just knew he would get manic. Mm-hmm. So manic was a word you would use. But bipolar, no. Or what it was, mm-hmm. you really didn't know. Mm-hmm. You know, crazy. There was a lot of euphemisms for what was going on. But, you know, when he was stable, he was great. Mm. But he hit lows. Mm-hmm. And he hit highs. And that just wreaked havoc on the family. Fortunately, and I don't know if they do this anymore, they did do electric shock therapy for him. And it stabilized them to some degree. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they do it now, maybe
they
low dose,
some.
But
mm-hmm.
He actually came out of that, and I didn't get the brunt of it. My brothers and sisters did. I'm the youngest of 5. Mm. And it affected them probably even more than me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had 2 brothers. They're gone now.
Mm-hmm.
One of them committed suicide, and the other one had bipolar, and in effect took his own life also.
Mm-hmm.
Just depressed.
And that was when you were already out of the house?
Yeah.
Everybody was out of the house?
Yeah,
then?
So my dad had passed away. My mom was still living. My one brother, who had bipolar, died, I guess he was in his early 40s. And you know, it was one of those diseases, as you know, left untreated. It doesn't get better.
He hadn't gotten a lot of care.
Well, again, here's the tricky part about it. The drugs just made him feel like a zombie.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he was high, he was hilarious,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it was, he didn't like that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't take the medication, you know, the highs are great, but the lows get real low.
They'll kill you.
And eventually you can't climb out. So
that
was hard. And then years after that, my older brother, who was 60,
mm-hmm.
He committed suicide.
Mm.
Yeah.
So hard, Fred.
It was hard.
Yes. And when we were growing up, there wasn't a way really for other families. And what's so powerful, I think, is now we're starting to understand, not starting to, we know all families have been touched, right?
Right, absolutely.
But when you're in it, I mean, my mom, as you know, schizophrenic, I lost a brother, a stepbrother, a stepsister, all to various accidents and traumas. I didn't talk about it outside of,
right.
I didn't talk about it in the family much.
Right.
We didn't talk about it outside the family. And so you were sort of alone in navigating the world with all this
Absolutely.
Stuff, right?
Yeah, there was certainly back in the 60s and 70s, there was shame associated with it, to admitting you had mental illness in your family.
If
you had known that everybody has some of it.
Right, and if it had anything to do with us.
Yeah. And
it didn't matter.
That's the hard part, right?
Yes.
And I think and that's why I love, you know, how Given Hour is moving into the change direction space. And
mm-hmm.
let's get it out there.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it.
Yes.
You know, I think there's a phrase you use or we use in Change Direction. You know, if you saw somebody having a heart attack, you'd help them.
Mm-hmm.
Why not if they're having mental issues, mm-hmm. right? And if they're honest about them and open about them, they can get the help. Mm-hmm. And how do we get that message out mm-hmm. so people really understand when they're having mental health issues and what they can do about it?
And the shame and the guilt, that's not only is it not relevant in a way, it's like, okay, you feel whatever you feel about having this challenge or this condition, but it's so unnecessary.
Right.
Because people, by and large, want to help.
Absolutely.
They want to step in. I think because of the work that we now are doing together with a whole bunch of other partners, we're seeing some changes, aren't we?
We absolutely are, which is great.
Yes. Right?
And I do think that if you realize people will help to the extent they can.
Right.
And I think there's educations on both sides. It's when you have the issue, can you come forward? And how do we educate other people? How do you react to that? Mm-hmm. What do you do? Mm-hmm. And I think that is the whole thing about change direction again, which I think can have profound impact worldwide.
That's what we're working on.
Yeah.
So here you were, the one out of your family who wasn't directly, you know, you had been affected, obviously,
yeah.
but you yourself were not dealing with bipolar disorder.
No.
And you went into the corporate space, went into HR, dealing with a lot of personnel folks. So I'm sure you saw a lot.
Absolutely.
Of stuff.
Yeah.
And at some point, you decided to step out of the corporate churn.
I did.
Talk about that.
Yeah. So I was in it for 27 years at just some fantastic companies. Some of the biggest, you know, great companies, had tremendous mentors and coaches and help along the way. And I felt, number one, I had done just about everything I could do in a corporate type setting. I had gotten into the companies I wanted to and the roles I wanted. And then 5 years ago, when my older brother killed himself, I think I just had a reset. Mm. I was at that time traveling a decent amount, and I still had 4 kids at home. And I just decided, you know what? It's time for me to just, I got to redo here. Money wasn't an issue, luckily for us. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough to be able to take some time off.
Was it scary?
It was. You know, what's funny, when you're an executive, not to boast that I'm an executive, but when you are, it's hard to
you
ask
were
for
an executive.
Help. I was,
yeah.
but it's hard to ask for help.
Mm.
And when you're in transition, especially one where you're not going to go into something else that you know, mm-hmm. it's disorienting.
And you were young. You still are young.
Relatively, yeah.
But in that corporate mindset of, I'm sure people are like, what are you doing?
And I needed to first heal a little bit about my brother and just a lot of stuff that I probably hadn't dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
So I took 6 months and did almost nothing, mm-hmm. right? Just a lot of Netflix, mm-hmm. relaxation, mm-hmm. power washing.
Mm-hmm.
But that gets old. And then I was like, I want to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But what?
Right.
I knew it wasn't corporate life.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the hard part?
So there are three things you did.
Three things I did.
That are very different, interesting, and I want to save the kind of the return to the corporate space last.
Okay, fine.
And because the other two are related.
Well, the third one is too now, but I'll explain that when I do it.
All right.
Yeah.
So the first thing you did was you wrote a sitcom.
Correct.
Yes.
Yes, that's
now,
right.
First of all, you are a very funny guy.
I'm really not. And that's the funny thing about it, right? You don't have to be funny to write a sitcom is what I've understood. You need to have a sense of funny.
Yes.
And I can sense funny.
And you need to have good material, right? Good stuff to work
well,
with?
Well, our sitcom didn't necessarily have good material, but yes, you should have good material uh-huh. in a sitcom.
But you didn't stop there.
I didn't stop there,
then
no.
Then you decided to
write a book.
Right,
that's
which
right.
We can, have.
You can hold that.
This is Fred's book.
That's right.
This is a book, New Fred.
That's right.
About writing the sitcom.
Correct. That's exactly what it
How
is.
How a middle-aged corporate guy created a sitcom, hired Ed Asner, and rediscovered career passion.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure people knew exactly what it was about on the cover.
So and they do.
Saying, well, if they don't know what it's about after reading that, I can't help
them. I know.
But yeah, so I wrote the book. I just was taking copious notes on this journey I was on. because I was enjoying it. I was really having, like, I found passion again. Mm-hmm. And I was writing stuff. And I was like, and I'm not a writer. I was a math major. Mm-hmm. I'm a terrible writer. And anybody who reads a book will probably say I'm a terrible writer. It's not bad.
No, it's good.
But I decided that it could be a book, you know, about my journey for sure. Mm-hmm. It was a bit cathartic for me because I talk about my family. Mm-hmm. I wrote it for my brothers. Mm-hmm. But I think it can help other people.
I do too.
Who are going through rough times.
I do too. And I will say because you know, I was really honored you asked me to read it. Yeah. And to give you feedback, and any men and women can read it and learn from it. I think about exactly what this series is all about, your inner space and how to tune into it, how to pay attention to it. It's funny. There's some interesting techniques that you use to tell your story, which I'm not going to spoil it, but people should go and check it out. But men in particular, I think, Fred, that there is something very, very powerful about the way that you tap into and share your own journey that I think can be helpful for men who typically maybe aren't so good at sharing their inner space, let alone recognize it's even there, let alone then share it with others or talk about it or work on it. So, I think it's funny. Even if you read it just as a interesting, wow, this guy wrote a sitcom. What the heck is that about? You're going to get stuff that maybe you weren't intending to get.
I hope so. I mean, it's in the end when I decided to push the button and actually do the book, I was hoping it could be helpful.
So the last thing I want to touch on before we say goodbye is you are now back doing some work with executives, different than what you had done before, very much, again, in keeping with this work, which is about inner space. And just briefly, this project that you're working on is really all about sort of an extension of the book for others. Is that fair?
Absolutely. It's the lessons I've learned through this journey of transition for me, I've kind of codified in a coaching program. And it's a software package with the help of an external coach that literally can help executives. We have a program for professionals now. We have one for veterans that help them transition from what maybe they've been doing their whole life to that next thing, but do it in a much more efficient and effective way, taking into account things like the emotional aspects of it, which it's a huge deal.
It's a huge deal, but that's not typically how people in the corporate space think about it, right?
No, I mean, what they think is I got to update my resume, get on LinkedIn. I'm like, no, you've got to kind of get your mind around mm-hmm. this is a big change for you mm-hmm. and accept that mm-hmm. and then figure out how you're going to manage your emotions throughout it.
And isn't that all about inner space?
It's all about
It's
that.
Like skill is this part, a little teeny chunk, important. But all the rest of that is about all those things you just said.
Absolutely. And that to me is if they have a way to think about that, it's a way of thinking is what the transition coaching really is. And they will make good decisions. They'll make good trade-offs because they'll know what trade-offs they're making.
Yep.
And I think that's the key.
It's the secret sauce.
I think so.
I do too.
You know what? I'm very excited. We're using it with veterans now. Veterans have a very tough time.
Absolutely.
Pivoting outside.
And I'm very proud that I don't know if you would have gone that direction in this work had you not been working with Given Hour.
100%.
I want to thank Fred Knowles for being my friend, for his dedication to and his unwavering support for Given Hour, and for being an inspiration to everyone he meets. His positive outlook on life is contagious and delightful. He reminds us that we should always try to keep an open mind and a good sense of humor. While having a good sense of humor can't protect us from experiencing emotional pain, it certainly can help us heal from the psychological wounds we all experience over the course of our lives. I want to thank all of my guests for sharing stories about their families, their losses, and their successes. Hopefully, by listening to the remarkable people who are sharing their experiences on Inner Space, you are gaining insights about yourself and perhaps about how your own family has shaped and affected your life, your outlook, and your emotional well-being. We all have an important role to play in the emotional lives of those we love. None of us are perfect. None of us are completely selfless. And none of us survive life without experiencing challenges and disappointment. Life isn't about avoiding pain or failure. It's about trying our best to be honest, open, vulnerable, and authentic. If we can do that most of the time, we will do so much to ensure our own well-being and the well-being of those near and dear to us. And remember that coming in June, the Campaign to Change Direction is hosting the first ever A Week to Change Direction. Check out changedirection.org to learn how you can be involved in A Week to Change Direction. And for information about how Inner Space is participating, visit dcpentertainment.com to learn more. Once again, I want to thank my wonderful team from DCP Entertainment for making this show possible. Y'all can follow me on Twitter at @bvandalen. Please use hashtag InnerSpace on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. And please share your journey with us about emotional well-being.